first episode in season two, our first book that we'll be reviewing is The Fortune Men by Nadifa Mohammed. So we take you all the way to Somalia. It's quite different from the other books we read, where we really dug deep into, like, you know, the history of the country, and we really dug into the stories inside the country. Whereas this one was mostly set in the UK, and it's all about Somali migrants to the UK. So it's quite an interesting perspective, but we will still try and, like, do a lot of updates on parts of Somali history. Yes, so before we take you there to that deep dive, we're going to just ask ourselves random questions so that you get to know us more and to loosen us up a bit as well.
Yeah,
right?
Yes.
So I'm going to start as the host.
Okay.
So I'm going to ask Ugochi 5 questions.
Okay.
So Ugochi, you have to be fast about this.
Okay, I'll try.
I'm telling her that because I'm so bad at this game, and she's so much better than me. So as I'm telling her, I'm telling myself. So you have to be fast. Don't think about it. Just go for the answer.
Okay.
5 questions. Favorite Nigerian dish?
Okra soup.
Favorite season in the year?
Autumn.
Favorite place visited?
Venice.
Ooh. Who has been the biggest influence in your life?
My grandfather.
What advice will you give your children on their first day at middle school?
Study smart, because you want to get that scholarship so we don't have to take out a loan for college.
Yes! I mean, no pressure. Right. So it's Ugochi's turn.
Okay. All right. Are you ready?
Yep.
Okay. Long nails or short nails?
Short nails, because I need to type for work.
Be honest, how often do you work from bed?
Never. Ooh. Because I'll just sleep off, so I can't do that.
Okay. Do you have a childhood nickname?
Yes. Oh my God, my name is Amara, and they used to call me Amala after, like, a Yoruba dish, which I hated Amala. So much.
Yeah.
Ooh. Amala and Iwedu. Ugh.
What did you think your life would be like when you were older?
I thought I would be like an archaeologist that, like, found the bones of Abraham and Moses, and just be like a Christian archaeologist, but that hasn't been the case.
What do you wish you had known 10 years ago?
10 years ago was 2012. Mm-hmm. I had just come back to Nigeria from the UK. Just do a lot of professional courses, because I'm finding it hard now to do a professional course because there's just too many distractions. But I wish I just focused on doing quite many courses and just realizing that 10 years later I would still need them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
All right, that's it.
Oh, thank you so much. Mm-hmm. All right, so back to the conversation. Current events.
Yeah. So I've been wanting to talk about this Jussie Smollett case.
Yeah.
So he was found guilty for staging a hoax or a hate crime on himself.
Yeah.
So we know, you know, you're familiar with the story, right?
Yes, yes.
Okay. So for our audience who might not know, he called in that he was...
He basically, from what I remember, this was 2 years ago, I think early 2019. So obviously he reported the crime to the station that he had been, that some homophobic people had attacked him.
Yes.
2 people. And I remember going through the emotions then. Like, I was upset. I was like, in this day and age, mm-hmm. it just seemed very, like, the perfect crime, kind of like a crime that really... like tore at our heartstrings, because I really felt it then. I was like, in this day and age, a popular you know, gay actor can still be experiencing this. So I was proper sad.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But yeah, carry on.
Yes, so he reported that hate crime, and then we found out that he hired 2 Nigerian who happen to be brothers to help him stage this crime. So they had an actual, they had made a noose out of rope But there's camera of Jesse going to get a Subway sandwich and I guess walking home. So they found out that this was a lie and he was just recently found guilty of that.
Mm-hmm.
But now he's, and he was sentenced to 100 days in prison.
Yeah.
100 days and plus probation and a fine. But now he's out of prison. So people are outraged or wondering why is he out of prison?
People are outraged.
They're outraged because he did lie. And when he was sentenced, there's video of him in court and he's saying that this is an injustice to him and he remains innocent. So a lot of people that I was seeing were like, you know, this guy is entitled, a bit narcissistic, perhaps. All they kind of wanted was an apology, like, you know,
is there anyone in the world that actually thinks he's telling the truth? I always wonder about that because I know Taraji Henson a couple of months ago came out and said the whole injustice thing and some of his other co-workers, not all of them. So I don't know if they think the crime actually happened, or I think how it's been reported and how he's basically like, so they know he's guilty, but like he's been basically hung from a rope and you know that the weight of it all.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what it is, but it's obviously like it was obviously a lie.
And Taraji recently came out and after his sentencing and said she related to Emmett Till.
Yeah, so that's what I'm saying. So yeah. I don't know whether she really thinks it's true or whether she's talking about, like, you know, how it's played out in the media.
I don't see how anyone can think that he's telling the truth. Even in his testimony, though, he told the real truth. Mm-hmm. So he's obviously guilty, but I don't know where Taraji's head is at. Like, when she said that, I honestly don't know. Do you think that he's innocent, or what about it played in the media that was bad?
Yeah, and I think the Nigerian brothers have come out to admit that Jussie Smollett paid them as well. So, yeah. But what do you think? Should he have been released early?
I don't think so, no. I think he should be in jail. But his release is like pending an appeal, right? So that's why they released him. And I think this is all because he, Kim Fox,
mm-hmm.
had made a deal with him when she was, I guess, supervising the case. But she recused herself because of the ties she had. I think she was caught with a text. She texted his sister or something and saying that...
Who is Kim Fox, by the way?
Kim Fox is the...
Prosecutor?
The prosecutor.
Yeah, I knew her.
Yeah. She texted his sister, I believe it was, and said he should be fine if, you know, he doesn't. So that's... She's too close to the case, too personal. So she recused herself. So I think Jussie's appeal is that, wait, this lady gave me a deal, and you know you guys aren't honoring the deal, but she had recused herself. So now the appeal is this deal valid, even though Kim Fox had appointed some people to overlook mm-hmm. the case, but since she recused herself, those people should also not be a part of that case because they were under her department.
Okay, so is that the argument you're going with?
Yes.
I mean, I don't know, as in if Jussie Smollett is narcissistic, which he appears to be, I would just be loving this. Like, I'm still the center of attention. This appeal, maybe they are going to like postpone it to end of the year. So I'm still going to be like heavily Google searched a lot.
Yes.
And I'm out of jail. Like my reputation is already spoiled, like that one, but I'm still trending. People are still going to want to interview me, so.
But would they want to interview him? Because his reputation is shot. So who would believe him?
No, but people like controversy.
True.
People love controversy. He might not be, the Netflix drama, the Anna Delvey. Did you watch it, Anna Delvey, or the Tinder Swindler?
I watched part of Tinder Swindler.
Yeah, so like their reputation is in the bin, but they've been paid by Netflix. Yeah. he's still having business deals, he's still having girlfriends, he's still having a large Instagram following, which I think now it's on private, but yeah, I think he's just been recently sued. But people love mess. The media loves mess.
Yeah.
And nothing is bad publicity.
Yeah, for someone like him. And yeah. There's a quote that says you can't shame someone with no morals.
You can't shame the shameless.
Yes.
So yes, it's interesting. But yeah, I think why that case stood out for me, because I just remembered feeling sad. It was 10 minutes of sadness, but I was just like, why in this day and age are people attacking this man? Like,
yeah. My, you don't need the conspiracy theorist.
Yeah.
When this came out, it was during some riots, right?
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah. So when this happened, there was another one that was reported that didn't get as much publicity.
Mm-hmm.
But I was like, oh, yes, this is... yes, this is real. And then who came out? Kamala Harris and some other celebrities were coming out.
Yeah, I think that's why I was like, yeah, because it got a lot of press.
But I, being my... Yeah, yeah. I think, don't trust those people. So when they were coming out saying things, I'm like, oh, this is definitely not real.
So that's why it was perfect. Like, we're probably going too long with this conversation. That's why it was perfect. Like, black man, a gay black man, you know, heavily bashed, whatever. It was perfect. It was perfect publicity for whichever celebrity wanted to ride on it.
Yes.
So that's why, to me, it just seemed too perfect.
Mm-hmm.
Pulled on our heartstrings. As you said, the right celebrities came out, did their thing. Yeah.
Yeah.
He almost got away with it. I don't know what happened. Like, the police must have a lot of, like, time on their hands, because for them to be finding CCTV of things. But I guess they were trying, because I think the whole nation, everyone was really trying to get those people. So I guess maybe that's why they dug deeper and then they saw a lot of inconsistencies. Because everyone was just like, no, this should not happen.
Yeah, during that time, especially. Yeah. And now there's some anti-lynching bill that...
Oh, okay.
I think has just been passed, or they're about to vote on it. I'm not sure. So people are saying... Is this related?
Oh.
Was it that he had the support of some important people to do this? I'm not the only one thinking it. I'm not the only crazy person out there. Other people are thinking it.
Conspiracy theories.
But it's just a theory, something to think about. It's not, I mean, who knows, right? But at the end of the day, I think he's guilty. I think he
should spend some time. Yeah, he's guilty.
In jail, he needs to feel that remorse. I don't think
will he ever do psychopath? No, he's not a psychopath. Do sociopath?
Yeah.
Ever do feel remorse? Crazy. Anyway, so that's 15 minutes of current events. Back to the book. So I'm going to leave it to Ugochi because she has a nice sultry voice. I'm going to leave it to her to kind of give a breakdown of the book we are going to review. And yeah, so hopefully, even if you didn't read the book or you didn't finish, this can kind of shed more light.
Okay. So I'm probably going to leave some things out. Just come in when you can.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So the setting of this book is in 1952. And it's about a man from Somaliland. His name is Mahmoud Matan.
Mm-hmm.
And he's living in Cardiff, which is Wales in the United Kingdom. And in a town called Bute Town. And Bute Town is near a port, a shipping port.
Mm-hmm.
So you have a lot of immigrants who live in Bute Town because of this shipping port. Is it that a lot of these immigrants are seamen?
Yes, most of them are seamen, or in a way connected to economies of the sea.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So the book starts off as with the king is dead. So the setting is in a man named Berlin's coffee shop. Berlin and Mahmoud are close friends. And the author describes Mahmoud as a confident guy who kind of does his own thing. He's a gambler. And he also has a Welsh wife with three boys, but who he does not live with. However, they had some marital issues.
Marital issues because of the pressure of the racial stigma. Mixed race couples were just not it at all. I don't think it was illegal, but it was not. It was frowned on by society.
Right. So it's just easier for them to stay apart. So Mahmoud had a gambling problem, which we'll get into later. The story also introduces another family. They're the Vlaki family. So we have Diana Vlaki, Violet Vlaki, who are sisters, and also Gracie Vlaki, who is Diana's daughter. This is another immigrant family. Their father, they're a Jewish family. Their father came from Russia to Butte Town, and he opened up a shop. It's like a secondhand shop, and they also cash checks from
in advance
by these seamen who come in. And, yeah. So Violet Vlaki manages the shop, and the story is centered around her murder. So she was murdered. And the police believe that it's a Somali man. So after she's murdered, the police are looking for this man. They come into Mahmoud's, where he lives. He's renting a room in a house where there's other immigrants.
Yeah.
Not all Somali, but I think they're all black. It's from somewhere. And Mahmoud shrugs the questions off. He doesn't believe that, he doesn't even know about the murder, but the police already have their eyes on him to catch and convict. So after Mahmoud is questioned, he goes about his life. I believe he did steal a coat for his wife. So the police got him on that and said, we're taking you in. And he believes it's because he stole the coat. But the police are already trying to make their case about the death of Violet Vlaki. So Mahmoud hires a lawyer who we should also talk about more, who tries to help him out. But Mahmoud doesn't understand the severity of why he's in jail and what they're about to charge him for. And they eventually charge him for the murder, and he's dumbfounded. He doesn't understand. Mm-hmm. And he believes that the UK government is a just place with a fair justice system. So he's heavily in denial. And time goes on, and he starts to understand the severity of what's going on. His lawyer is not much. He is of help, but Mahmoud doesn't answer questions the way he should be answering them, because he does not, because of his personality.
Because of his personality, and because he just believes that this is bullshit. You know, I didn't do it. You're saying I did it. This is bullshit kind of thing. So he keeps being very resistant and hostile, even to his lawyer.
Mm-hmm. So he becomes very angry. In his jail cell, you see him. He's not eating. He's losing weight. But through the book, he starts to accept what's happening to him. So you kind of see his humanness kind of go away as he's accepting his fate. So he grows a stronger relationship, I believe, with his wife. He starts to understand maybe what he should have been doing before this all happened with his family. And he's eventually hanged for that crime. So that's, you have anything to add?
Yeah, that's it. So the epilogue, obviously, this is a real true life. Well, a semi-biography. So that means that some parts are fictionalized. But obviously after the hanging, his wife Laura, who's also a real life character, tried to fight for him to clear his name and to overturn the convicted verdict. And for years and years, she did it. A couple of mayors of the town refused it, but finally it got accepted in 1998, and they overturned his conviction and also gave them the permission to change his gravesite, so to basically transfer his body to a more suitable place, not the prison, for him to be properly buried. Around, I think, in 1996, then his conviction was overturned in 1998, and the family got a lump sum of £1.4 million, and it was the first time like the British courts had ever admitted to wrongfully accusing a person. So it was quite a milestone mm-hmm. in the criminal justice system. Mm-hmm. And yes, unfortunately, none of his children are alive today. They died before the age of 70. The wife is also late. She died in 2003, I believe. And yes, and so it's quite admirable that this author, through research, through going through a lot of documents, and through interviews with people that knew Mahmoud, was able to put together a really like heartfelt story of not only what happened to him externally, but his thoughts and what it must have felt like going through all those emotions. Mm-hmm. From you really not doing anything and you being hanged, knowing that you didn't do anything, but no one else is buying that. Mm-hmm. So it's very admirable that happened. So we're just going to talk about a few themes about the book. I really hope you enjoyed the book as well, as much as we did. So identity is like our first theme, talking about... you know, how Mahmoud really fitted into the Tiger Bay built town community as a first generation Somalian mm-hmm. Who didn't even speak English well enough. He kept the times where he was breaking into and preaching English. Mm-hmm. And just the fact that racism was rife. It was there. You could see it. I mean, he did his own thing by marrying Laura, a white Welsh lady, but they didn't live together. He had to live on... They lived in the same street, but different houses because of the racial tension of them being together. Even Laura's family didn't allow him live inside. Like, they had their own marital tiff, but I think there was just a lot of external pressure that didn't even let them survive, even, you know, the first day. So there was that, the marriage, and then that self-fulfilling prophecy where, obviously, it's fiction and we don't know why he started stealing, but the author made it kind of sound like it became a self-fulfilling prophecy. He was a good guy, and then 18 months to the end of his life, he just completely changed, and it all started when that woman was kind of like hugging her bag when she saw him walking on the street. Mm-hmm. And then he was just like, well, if these people are going to take me for a thief, I might as well just do it.
Yeah. Yeah.
So what do you think? Identity, what comes to your mind?
I think that he came into the UK kind of thinking that the UK was everything perfect, it seems like, because he didn't believe that the justice system could do that to him. So he thought the UK had a fair justice system. He married a Welsh wife. Nothing wrong with marrying a Welsh wife, but there's a quote in the book where someone told him, you don't come all this way for a skirt that looks like your mama. So it seemed like he was trying to get away from his blackness, the fact that he was black, and adopt something else, it seemed like. So he came to the realization later on in the book before he died that, yes, he is black. And this is the reality of being a black person.
House nigger, field nigger, yeah, still niggers.
Yeah.
But I think, so his wife, I tried to look for interviews with his wife. It just didn't exist on the internet. And Vimeo, there was one interview, but I had to like log in and I didn't want to do that. But I hear in the interview, his wife was saying stuff like, Mahmoud just did his thing. He just didn't know his place. Like, he didn't see color. He He wore the nicest clothes. He tried to look even more British than the Englishman.
Mm-hmm.
And he had nice scarves, a hat. And he just didn't know his... Sometimes he just forgot that he was black.
Mm-hmm.
So to him, nothing was beyond reach. Mm-hmm. Everything was there for him. And obviously, so that kind of tension in your personality, and then realizing that in all aspects of life, everyone just keeps hitting you down for this skin color. I think the author was just trying to say that things changed towards the end of his life, and that pressure kind of took hold of him, and he just became a menace to himself. And even the last day before he went to prison, he just kept saying, okay, I got a job. He told Laura, and I think the next day he was going to start, or the next Monday. So again, this is fiction. We don't know if that happened, but he just seemed like he was a good guy, but just under a lot of societal pressure. Yeah. Why are you shaking your head?
I do believe that he was a good guy. Societal pressure. I don't know, because it seemed like he wasn't even in cohesiveness with his own Somali community.
Yeah, that's true.
So it seems like his personality was just kind of defiant.
Yeah. And so that's one part of identity we were reviewing. So mm-hmm. the color of his skin. But I think even going back to the plot in when he was in Somalia, like, him being the last born of his parents, you know, he was born in their old age. He was also born when they were starting to get a bit wealthy.
Mm-hmm.
So I kind of deduced that he was a bit entitled.
Mm-hmm.
Everything was kind of laid out for him. Like, he obviously, there was that scene where his mom was starving and it was during the famine. And so his mom became extra protective. But obviously, he doesn't remember that. All he remembers is the fact that they were a bit comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
And so it seems like he grew up where everybody had the answers, which is always the case when you're the last in the family.
Yeah. And you have a bit more freedom to do what you want to do.
Whereas
those who are older than you, who don't have things laid out for you, for them, they have to figure things out and make, you know, rational decisions.
Exactly. So I was thinking as well that I think that formed into his personality, where he was a bit restless, mm-hmm. but just more a bit entitled. I just wonder if someone with a different personality would have treated the severity of his situation more seriously. Like, obviously he couldn't believe it. He was in denial, and that's fair enough. But, you know, even in the courts, that final chance for you to just make an impression, he was still not answering questions. So that was a bit strange. And he could have been a bit more cooperative, maybe.
Yeah,
I don't think it would have made a difference. I don't know.
It might have.
It might have, right?
The reason why he had an alibi, he just didn't want to use the alibi because he didn't want to embarrass his wife or have his wife think of him, because he was with a Russian woman. That's who he went to see.
Really?
Yeah.
When? During the time of the murder?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't get that from the book. I thought he was like with the mother-in-law and stuff.
No, he's with the Russian. He was with the mother-in-law earlier,
mm-hmm.
but before he had gone back to his room at home, he went to see a Russian woman.
I didn't even know that.
Yeah, so he didn't want his wife to know that.
So where was the Russian woman?
He didn't bring her up.
Oh, that's crazy.
So to know that the severity of your case, you still don't want to bring, because that showed me that how much he loves his wife also.
She loves his wife. I'm very proud, but yeah.
And
yeah.
Very proud, yeah.
Yeah, so he was just a bit proud. You just wonder if, you know, someone with a different personality would have acted a bit differently.
Yeah.
But yeah, another theme that was interesting to us was the immigration part of the story. So as we said earlier, like usually when we do stories from a different country, we usually it's more set in that country, whereas this one is the UK. So the obvious tie is immigration.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting that you have two different immigrant families that the author is describing, Mahmoud and the family of the deceased, Violet. So for me, I saw, because Jewish people during that time as well were not looked favorably upon, although for Black people, it's easier to spot, you know, a Black person and say, oh, you're very different, versus a Jewish person and say you're very different. But the Vlaki father came in and kind of integrated in society by opening his shop. So people saw him as someone respectable in the community. So the cop made a reference in the book to Diana and said, we're going to try to help you with this case and do all that we can. Your father was a reputable person. So I saw that and I started to think of Mahmoud. I know that, you know, being Black during that time was difficult. But what if Mahmoud was an upstanding citizen and had gained favor in the community, like a trust in the community? Would they have gone after him the way that they did?
No, you're absolutely right. And we had a discussion earlier and I was like, well, who gave the Russian man the money in the first place to start his shop? Like, he must have had goodwill, and that's because of his color of his skin. But, and you know, Mahmoud, maybe Mahmoud never stood a chance, and that was my argument. But at the same time, in the book, they mentioned a Nigerian watchmaker. So he had his shop. He was a good standing citizen. In fact, good enough for other people to steal from him, but at least had a shop. And you just kind of wonder, you know, color of the skin, color of the skin, but there are people that were, you know, just ignoring all that and making it, even being Black. So yes, you just tend to wonder. But again, the interview I watched with the author and other people reviewing the book, you know, they were saying that even the Vlaki family, even they were not perfect, they were not conventional. And maybe it explains why they were huddled up together. Because Maggie, their sister, the middle sister, who seemed to have a normal family dynamic of a man, woman, probably children, actually lived away. And the two sisters who had, like, who were kind of alternative lifestyle, you had Violet, who was never married and was more business than, you know, the women in those times would have been, and again, not married. And then you had Diana, who, even if, yes, yeah, she did marry, her husband died, but it seemed like she was young enough to be married, but chose not to, with her daughter. So they were huddled up, and it just seemed like they were also a bit isolated. There was a nice scene where Diana is just looking out into the streets and seeing the parade, and it just seemed that she was a bit of an outsider. So were they really good immigrants, would you say, or is it just gray, where there is just you being different is enough for people to just categorize you the way you want to be categorized, kind of, or you don't want to be categorized?
Being a good immigrant, they could still be, I don't know what a good immigrant would be, but people still trusted them.
People still trusted them.
They came into the shop, they cashed their checks.
They
opened the shop late for some people who were straddlers who came in late. So everyone knew them as trustworthy people.
More, let's just use the word more, comparatively,
in comparison,
yes,
too.
Because, yeah, I still see them, or they were still viewed as outsiders in the way the author describes certain parts of their character and certain plots as well. And then, yes, I guess it's just that idea of what is a good, so how is a good immigrant expected to behave? Is it more like the Vlaki family, but just man, woman, just be white And you're okay.
No, I think that it's important to establish some type of, or to portray something that would make others trust you who don't know you.
I was going to say that, like, you've said that a couple of times, that as an immigrant alone, coming into a new place, you're obviously distrusted, not liked, you know, everybody's suspicious because they don't know you.
They don't know you. That's, yeah.
So the best way for them to know you or to open up to you is to show that you're trying to accept them, mm-hmm. and trying to assimilate their culture, rather than you're different, you now become more, even more different, or even stark different, mm-hmm. and that's what they're afraid of, mm-hmm. and that's what, yeah, you don't like what you don't know, or you're not used to.
Yeah,
that's
just human nature.
Like, ooh, said jeez. So yes, so I guess there's that as well. And Mahmood, but Mahmood was assimilating. He was being British, you know, he's dressing.
But to who?
I don't know. The way the author described it, it seemed like he was almost like the Volaki family. He worked as a seaman. He was well-traveled, so he was exposed enough to have conversations with the right people. But society broke him down.
But those people, the seamen, are off. Like, they're not living in his community to help him.
Yeah.
So he's trusted in his job, mm-hmm. which is good. So if anything happens, they're not going to go and suspect him because they know him.
Yeah.
But in his community where he's living, where he
was. Yeah. Yes, you're right. Even the argument, he fought with the Somalis, he's fought with the people from the Yemeni, mm-hmm. people, mm-hmm. as well. So it's that thing where you can see the societal pressure as well on him, but there was something belligerent about his character, yeah.
That didn't help him.
Yes.
Yeah.
So the third theme was obviously the elephant in the room, which is the fact that he was executed for a crime he did not commit. You know, right from when he was arrested to when he was put to death, he just kept screaming for the fact that he's innocent. His wife knew that. Belly knew that. You know, any average person that just even ran through, you know, facts and documents of this case would probably draw the same conclusions. Mm-hmm. So what do you think about that?
That they all thought he was innocent?
Killed by injustice. Okay, that was what was written on his gravestone.
Yeah. It's really sad. It is really sad.
I think why I wrote that as a theme is because it must have been suffocating for him. Like, you're arrested, you know, okay, fine. He's gotten arrested in the past. All the police officers knew his name. So he didn't take it seriously. He thought it was a stolen coat. That's why he got arrested. And then it just got progressively worse. He stayed in jail for a couple of weeks and then he was finally tried. And okay, guilty, death by hanging. And he was like, I don't know what's going on here. Mm-hmm. Again, that not entitlement, but that bit of, okay, I can't get out of this. You know, everyone has laid solutions for me in the past. He kept saying that, like, friends with the doctor, everything. And it just got progressively worse where, okay, you know, the doctor kept seeing him to check his weight to see whether the rope would be strong enough. Selected his suits, and then finally, like last days, he had to change his cell, and it dawned on him that for walking down the street and minding his business, he's going to be hanged. He's going to be people planned, like there's a whole institution. He tried to appeal, that was rejected. He tried to get a royal pardon, that was stopped as well. So it must be suffocating that you're the only person screaming from your lungs, doing everything you can, and nobody believes you. And finally, you are hanged. Like, I think the way the author kind of went through it was really great, because even when they were putting the white cloth, I was like, it's a lie. There's going to be a different outcome.
The reason why I paused is because, yeah, it's sad, but the whole time I was saying, why didn't you just tell the truth? Why didn't you answer questions? Why did you have to not be close to your Somali people? Yeah. And those are the questions. And so I think I was more frustrated at that than him. I accepted that he was going to die because he didn't do those things. So I was more
Would it really have made a difference?
It might not have made a difference, but it would make a difference in the way I felt about...
Oh, because a lot of the reviews I read after I read the book were like... I mean, his lawyer did say he was half savage, half human, half savage or something like that.
Yeah.
I mean, by the time you describe someone like that in court, you're basically putting a whole fat wedge between you, him, and everyone else. Because you're not seeing him as human. Mm-hmm. So you're not seeing him as someone that could be your brother, your sister, your father. You're basically trying an animal and trying to decide whether he's animal enough. Like,
I was like, could you have found a different wording to express whatever you were trying, whatever point you're trying to get at? That was harsh. But was it a last-ditch attempt because the evidence was... Not evidence, but all the testimonies was really bad.
I think a lot of the reviews I read after I really honed in on that half savage, half human, the truth of the matter is that that was the time then. He had used it in his, I think he had used it in a previous case for another Somali guy. I'm not sure if the guy got off, I'm not sure. But the truth of the fact that he's just playing to what the society, it was acceptable to say at that time. I mean, everybody can say, oh, but yeah, all that's in retrospect. The truth of the matter, the person that really put him, really hanged him was the policeman who kept changing, who altered a lot of evidence and tampered with a lot of witness testimonies. I mean, Diana and her daughter said, this is not the man. The man we saw had mustache. The man we saw had this. This is not the guy. You know, Harold Cover kept going back and forth because they paid him and stuff. Then that other weird lady, Mrs. May.
Yeah, yes, who also had a shop, right?
Yeah, who had a shop and was trying to get Laura's mother to share the reward with her. So those are the people that really messed it up for him.
Yeah.
I hear Harold Cover was 10 years down the line, he was arrested for slitting his daughter's throat. You know, so I don't know, it was just bizarre. It's really the policeman, and I'm surprised I didn't get more information about what happened to him.
Yeah, he really had it out for him. I mean, bad guy.
Were you going to say something else about the lawyer?
The lawyer, yeah. So initially I was upset with the lawyer. It's like, you're not trying hard enough. But then I had to realize, like, Mahmoud didn't give much for him to work with because he lied initially.
He kept lying. Why did he keep... Okay, you told me because he was the Russian lady, but
yeah.
He just kept lying. Like, I didn't even know he stopped at his mother-in-law's house. I didn't... He kept lying about the times.
Yeah, he kept lying. So the lawyer didn't have trust in him. So it's like the lawyer was kind of trying to make a case out of thin air and trying to make things stick.
Yeah.
And so I couldn't be that upset. The savage part, that wasn't cool. But I was really upset with the lawyer initially, but then I kind of understood the lawyer's frustration towards the end.
Yeah. Okay, so another interesting thing about this book is that even if it wasn't set in Somalia, it had quite a lot of like significant Somalian events around that time that we had to do a lot of research on to just find out more what was going on, kind of set the scene. You know, what Mahmoud was escaping from and what he was kind of heading to in terms of England. So we're going to just delve through, like, just quickly certain topics we found very interesting that can kind of give a better explanation of the time period. So the first was Dervish Wars. Mm-hmm. That was mentioned because I think Mahmud was just born sometime after that. So the Dervish Wars took place in the very early 1900s. I think it started in 1899. Their leader was a guy called Said, and his followers were called the Dervish people. He recruited people from all over Somalia, and it was usually the youth, basically fighting the British resistance, basically just fighting the British occupation of their land. And it just took a different turn where it just became like a guerrilla fight. And they had some successes. So around like the 1900s to like maybe 1915. So at that point, obviously the British attention was drawn towards the First World War. So they kind of let them do their thing. Still a lot of fighting, but I think the British kind of relocated to the coastal areas. And then in 1920, the British just had enough. So they kind of just had like an enormous attack. And that kind of destroyed, ended the Dervish War. And then finally, the leader died of influenza or malaria in 1920. And that, like, ended things. So the British carried on with their rule of the part of Somaliland they occupied. Mm-hmm. So that's about the Dervish War. So the character, the Haji, which was mentioned in this book, was, I think he was kind of revived what was going on in the Dervish Wars. Mm-hmm. But obviously that didn't last long because, again, the British people were like, what's this rubbish? And they just ended it like, go away. Like, the way they described the British forces, like, they were swatting away flies. Like, yeah. Okay, you've had your 15 minutes of fame. Now, I mean, let's swat you away. Yeah. So that's what the Haji character kind of related to, and when they described the Dervish War. So that had just taken place. Another fact about the Dervish War is that it was quite severe. It lasted for such a long time. I think about 20 years. It was one of the like severe resistance during the colonial empire of the British in Africa, and it wiped out like a third of the British Somaliland population and obviously killed their economy. So that's the, and obviously they were going through famine because of years of drought, and that's the period to which Mahmud was born.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you say why the Dervish War started, or what was the aim?
Into resistance of the British. Was there something else?
I think I read that they aim to restore the Islamic system of government.
Yeah, that as well. Yeah. That was important as well.
Yeah.
So the other important part was obviously the fascination, the fact there was Italian Somaliland and British Somaliland. So we also did a deep dive to kind of the creation of Somalia. We're obviously fascinated with the way Somalia was formed after, you know, the book kept mentioning British Somaliland, Italian Somaliland. So how the British Somaliland was formed was basically, the British had earlier on in the 1800s, they had occupied Egypt and they had colonized Egypt. So obviously, all the powers under Egypt just indirectly went to them, and that's how they like encroached on Somaliland in the first place. But the Italians, because of Mussolini and the fascist movement and the fact that he wanted more colonies in Africa and he was forming the Empire of East Africa, occupied the coastal areas of Somalia. The French people also had their little bit, which is to this day known as Djibouti.
Yeah, I say Djibouti, but no, I think it's the way I learned it in school. The way I remember it.
The one I learned, I think it's Nigeria. I don't know, but it's Djibouti. Anyway, so they occupied a small area, which is today known as that country, and yes, and it was called French Somaliland. So you have these three forces. Then there was Ethiopia coming in from like the landlocked area of the west to control Ogden. But I think now to this day, Ogden is part of Ethiopia, I think. So it's only British Somaliland to the northwest. Puntland?
Yes.
Puntland.
Puntland or Puntland.
Puntland to the northeast. And then the coastal areas, which is along the east and the southern part, is Italian Somaliland, which today is known as Somalia. So that was going on in around like the 1920s and 30s. So you had French, Italian, and British. And then it's the Italian forces, again, Mussolini trying to control, get more territories in East Africa, decided to invade the British part. And for a while, they took over the British Somaliland. But obviously, because of the Second World War and how it was playing out, as you know, Mussolini was more with the Nazis. Their attention was more focused there. So when the British attacked to claim that back their land, they kind of just succumbed and were pushed back to Italian Somaliland. And then, so the two forces were Italian and British Somaliland. And then in 1960, they decided to separately get independence. So British Somaliland got independence. 5 days later, Italian Somaliland got independence. But later that year, they decided to come together as Somalia. However, more wars broke out in the 80s. And then in 1991, British Somaliland, which is today is known as Somaliland, decided that they've had it. So from 1991 to date, they are quite independent. They have their own currency, their own government. They are quite independent. It's just that they've not been internationally recognized as a separate country, even if they run, like, I think you need visas to go in there. Like, they have their own thing going on. And I hear it's relatively peaceful, except the sporadic outbreak of like clashes with them and Puntland, because it's quite close to them. But they are relatively, and they are just doing their thing as an independent, not recognized country.
So
that was very intriguing for us, even if the book didn't cover it. So we just thought we should shed more light, because we did do a lot of research. Have I covered everything? Because we spent a bit
of time researching Somaliland and how it came to be. I think you've gotten most of it, which is important. But it would be nice to read a book covering that history. It seems like a very interesting history.
Very interesting. It just seemed like a melting pot. So
yeah.
As a Somalian, I think that's what, yeah. I have the possibility of speaking Italian, French, English, Swahili.
Mm-hmm.
Melting pot. Like, I can imagine like the different superpowers and their influences on the culture of it is.
Right. Yeah. And that would be really interesting. And Mahmoud spoke how many languages? He spoke like five languages. I wonder.
That could be what I think the average Somalian probably speaks. More than two languages.
Definitely, yeah.
Yeah. So that's interesting. Yeah. So what was the third intrigue for us?
The third intrigue was something that they mentioned in the book. So Berlin was telling a story of how he, I guess, basically came to the West. Berlin is from Somaliland. And he was recruited to get on a ship or boat and go to the UK. Under the guise of, oh, they will feed us and take care of us. So a lot of Somaliland people went on this ship to the UK, and the book describes that when the ship doors opened, there's a cameraman taking pictures. He's like, oh wow, this is great, this is cool. But then he found out later on why he was there. They had brought them over to kind of display them because they looked so different from the white people. So they were put on display, they were kind of showcased.
Yeah, kind of showcased, kind of like, you know, immense experience. Is that what it's called? Like an immersive experience. So I think this stood out for me in the book because obviously I work in the charity sector.
Yeah.
And a lot of NGOs have come under fire for creating that immersive experience. So what it is that they have, it's very weird. So they have, sometimes they have a bus or sometimes they have like a space in a mall where they create what like an African child goes through.
Yeah.
So the walls, there's a lot of like African print material everywhere and there's like a mat. And it's just crazy, like no, maybe one stringy light, and they want people to come in and see what like the African child goes through. So I was part of the people that were like, this is just not right or cool.
Yeah.
So when I read this in the book, I was like, okay, so it's not today now.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that now we should know better. I understand why they would do it back then, but like, the people that really thought it would be a good idea to do this, didn't they think, like, where's the dignity in...
Do this, like, back then?
Yeah?
Back then?
Yeah, no. Uh-huh. What, didn't they say, oh, this was done back then and this was a bit creepy? Like, why would we take that same approach now?
Yeah, right, now.
But yeah, so to set the scene of what Ugochi is trying to say, like... So, like, they invited, like, groups of Africans. It could be, like, a whole family, expansive of many wives and children. Obviously, they wore hide and skin and leather and had, like, spears. But you had to come with all that. That was all part of the package. They shipped you that way with your... You had to be building huts and making fires and stuff. They shipped you that way all the way to a museum-like place.
Mm-hmm.
And put you on display where people paid money to come and watch you. I don't know if you know the story of Hottentot Venus, but something like that, but just more theatrical because you're meant to act normal as an African. You act normal, you cook, but people are watching you and laughing mm-hmm. and poking you to see if, like, as the book says, see if the black rubs off.
Yeah.
And laughing, and then it's a tour, so... You're put in a place, you pack up, you get paid, or your organizers get paid, and they go to another town.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how Berlin was able to come out of South and Somalia, but obviously... And it happened in real life as well to the real Berlin, because the author interviewed the real Berlin. Mm-hmm. And yes, I think he talked about how... Is that happened to him or happened to his grandfather? I mixed the two, but mm-hmm. So it's a real thing.
Yeah, it's a real thing. And in the book, Berlin described it as kind of being like akin to an animal.
Yes.
It felt like...
Like a zoo.
Like a zoo.
Because, yeah, on the tour, it wasn't just them. It was the clownish, whatever, act.
Yeah.
But also animals.
And animals. And it wasn't just Africans. It was...
Yes.
Like, it wasn't natives just from all over the world, it seems like.
Yes.
Because he made a friend who was a Mohawk from Canada.
Yes. So, yes, just to say, at least it wasn't just, you know, Africa. It was just... But again, that's what was normal mm-hmm. in those days. Mm-hmm. Human rights, the notion of human rights and all human beings are equal only came about in 1945. So, yeah, before then, it was a bit...
rough.
Yeah, it was a bit rough. All right, guys, we've come to the end of our review. Oh, my God, this was actually interesting. I think this is actually easier than audio. I don't know, but...
Don't have
comes,
to think as much.
Yeah. So the last thing is just, what's your favorite or inspirational quotes in the book?
Ooh, this is my thing, yo.
Yeah, I leave you to do that.
Okay, so let me read it. Hargesa Sky. Okay, this is Mahmood speaking. And this is when he was in jail, just kind of reflecting of everything. Hargeisa's sky reminded him of God, while Cardiff's sky suffocated his faith and separated him from God. So I thought that was interesting because it felt like maybe his whole life, he's kind of running away from his land, Somaliland, trying to, in search for greener pastures. But it was towards the end of his life where he realized that home is where the heart is.
Home is where the heart, at least, yeah, at least you won't be publicly executed.
You wouldn't be publicly, you wouldn't be judged for your skin color because everyone kind of looks like you. Just different experience. And then at that point, I started to ask, why did you leave? Why are you in the UK? You know, I think someone asked that question in one of the interviews. Mm-hmm. Why did he leave? Or why do immigrants leave to come to the UK? Some question like that.
Yeah.
Or the author.
She really had a clap back. So the guy was like, if you guys are complaining about the injustice of the UK system, why are you guys in the UK? Why come to the UK? And the author was just ready, like completely composed. Nadifa just gave him a really good answer. I don't remember a lot of what she said, but she was just like, and it's what we were talking about. What is a good or bad immigrant? Mm-hmm. Like, we are just being ourselves. If you see a situation wrong, what you shouldn't say because you should be eternally grateful because you're in the UK.
Right.
You speak up and you own it, you know, based on your own principles as well. Not because, oh, you're born to hate the UK because you're deep. No, but based on your own principles. And she gave an example that she's always been against the death penalty and it's good it's been banned in the UK. But also when she went back to she just found out recently in Somalia that has been reinstated, the death penalty. And of course, she's also against it. So it's not just the UK that has its issues. It's just about standing up to your principles and realizing you're more than just a grateful immigrant.
Right. That's important. Because if you keep walking around like that, well, I'm a grateful immigrant, you know, mm-hmm. that's kind of going to minimize how people see you. People are going to continue to look down on you even more so, right? You lose your pride.
And not even that. What is a grateful immigrant? We're all immigrants, you know, in a way. The whole of the U.S. is just immigrant populations that have come in at different times. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, just for people to realize that. I mean, the British people seem to have been long. Stayed quite long in the UK, but not the point. In other normal parts of the world, most times they're populations that have just melted into one and formed nations, but all come from different places. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I guess the last thing is just, is there anything you didn't like about the book?
In the beginning, I thought it was, she used a lot of descriptive words, like descriptive adjectives. Mm-hmm. So it was kind of draining for me, maybe because it was in the beginning of the book and I didn't really know what was going on. I didn't like that. And also, sometimes I didn't know which character was speaking. So I got confused. I was confused a bit in the beginning until I kind of figured that out.
Yeah, it was a struggle, but I think with most books, and just because my time is competing with so many other things, I just found it difficult to reach page 100. But once Mahmood was arrested, I think things took off quite easily. Mm-hmm. I think there were good characters that kind of faded off. We talked about it, like, she just kind of wrote them off midway, and by the end, it was only, like, Diana's story and Laura and Mahmood that was heavily concentrated on, whereas Berlin had quite an interesting life.
It did.
And yeah, other characters. So I've been good to hear about Maggie, the other sister, and you know what she thought about everything, but she seemed quite distant. And then also Diana, what she thought about the execution right to the end. But I think maybe the author was trying to be respectful of, you know, that what family they've asked her to write in the story and what they've kind of requested for her to leave out, mm-hmm. so that mm-hmm. it's just fair to everybody. And yeah, as somebody said in a review, the question of this book is not about whether you like it or not, or whether it's high quality or low quality. It's just great admiration for the author to take on the task of writing about somebody that no documents really, probably, it was probably really hard to get documents, or it's only very formal, straight line documentation.
Yeah.
All his immediate family were dead.
Yeah.
You know? And to take on that task of really just not only writing about the story, but writing his thoughts, what he must have gone through, and making his character really come out live.
Yeah, given what she had.
Yeah.
The story. So she did a good job with that.
So she did a really good job. Mm-hmm. All right, we've come to the end of our episode. This was quite interesting. Yes, so... as usual, please like, subscribe, and follow us on all our social media handles. Afroreads Podcast on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. And also listen to us everywhere you listen to podcasts. Anchor FM, Spotify, YouTube, Stitcher, you name it. Our next book is going to be...
Behold the Dreamer.
Yes, by Mbolo Mbue. I think Mbolo Mbue. Yes.
You're really good memory.
I know. Long term. I don't have good short term memory. But yes, and we'll take you all the way to Cameroon.
Yeah.
So watch this space. And yes, I hope you liked this review.
Yes.
Bye for now.
Bye.